Presidential Committee on Government Personnel on Twitter. It is 8:46 on Thursday, April 14, 2022, in Davis, Ward 6. Members present are Representative Rojas, Vice Chair, Representative Fields, Representative Tarr, and myself, Representative Zelensky, Chair. Let the record reflect that we are required to conduct business. For those in the room, please use this time to turn off your cell phones. For those of you who are home, please make yourself if you are not speaking. Before we begin, I would like to thank Lee Frazier, the House Foreign Affairs Secretary for my words during this rally today, and Natalia Ames, who is chairman of the Senate for staff in the committee today. To lead off today's meeting, I thought it would be worthwhile and helpful for us to hear a presentation on the topic of opting from Natasha Singh, Vice President of Legal Affairs for the last committee to Title Health. First time, as we all know, Title Health has shown solid returns on tribal contracting for the year lasted for over 4 decades. Ms. Singh, if you could begin by putting yourself on the record and beginning your presentation. And you do have your slide deck pulled up to go ahead and advise me to advance to the next slide.
Natasha, can you hear us?
Yes, it's okay. Can you hear us? Yeah, I'm trying to turn my email phone up, but I think I just turned this out. Or I'm just turned out my email phone. So, you might hear my email.
Okay, so we are back on the record, and let's see if you want to go ahead and put yourself on the record and begin your presentation. And we have your PowerPoint set up, so just advise when it needs to be passed to the next slide.
Okay, thanks. You can probably put up my first slide where it says my name. Hello, everyone. This is Natasha Singh. I am presenting for Gingrich. I'm the VP of Legal Affairs for Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. And I'm very honored to present an overview of tribal compacting. So, on the next slide, today I'll be discussing three main things. We'll do an overview of tribal self determination, laying the foundation of tribal compacting, and then we'll talk about two examples of tribal compacting, one a federal example and one a state example. Next slide, please. So, many of you probably know this, but I'll just review a nice little history lesson. The United States government has had a relationship with tribes for centuries, way longer than the state of Alaska has existed. And within that relationship, there has been specific eras of congressional policy to deal with what they refer to historically as the Indian problem. The first era was the colonial era, then was the removal era, Trove Tears. Next was the treaty era. Next was the allotment era, where they tried to divide up Indian land and international allotments because of that era. And the Indian reorganization era, I refer to as like the Big Brother era, where the Congress and
thought that what I should be doing. That didn't work, so they moved into the termination era where Congress started terminating the relationship with tribes in the United States government. Unfortunately, tribes that still, the tribal governments still existed on the tribal side, so it really didn't work either. And then along comes President Nixon, who was fortunate enough to be, have close relationships with some tribal citizens, and he was really the champion of what we refer to as the tribal self-determination era, and that's the era we're in, has been the only successful federal Indian policy in the history of the country. And it's a very simple concept. Best outcomes are achieved when tribal citizens and tribes decide and implement programs and services for themselves. Next slide, please. Of course, this very simple concept resulted in a very complex federal statute, the Indian Self-Determination Act of 1975. And that is the statute which authorizes the tribes to enter into contracts or compacts to take over services that the federal government is responsible for providing Alaska Native and American Indian people. Again, this is the only policy that has worked to make progress in reversing health disparities and social determinants of health. And it's the only policy that has really worked to improve the conditions of our Native communities. This policy has worked so well, and it really reflects a political equilibrium. It has withstood for decades of various shifts in party control of Congress and House. And I think it's because it's just a very simple policy that is local control, and the people who benefit from the services should be the ones determining how those services are implemented on the ground. Next slide, please. So what is tribal contracting? So the federal law authorizes tribes and tribal organizations to enter into a legal agreement, a contract or compact, with the federal government to provide program, functions, services, and activities that the federal government would otherwise provide tribal citizens. So basically a legal agreement between the federal government and the tribes, where the tribes take over responsibility to implement services. So please remember this is a political relationship. It's government to government. It's not race-based. It's also based on our federal government's federal trust responsibility to the tribes in this country. And tribal compacting isn't just handing over the responsibility. It's handing over, the United States hands over the responsibility along with the authority and funding to fulfill the responsibility. Next slide, please. So in the federal realm, you have two possible legal agreements that tribes can enter into with the United States government. One is a contract and one is a compact. A contract is allowed under Title I of the Indian Self-Determination Act, and it's kind of like the first step to compacting in the federal side. You have to meet certain while you're contracting. You are planning for your compact. You have to show the government that you have had a successful contract to enter into a compact. Separate from the next compact I'd like to talk to you about is a state compact. It's not tribal child growth labor compact. And this is an intergovernmental agreement between the state of Alaska and 18 federally recognized tribes and organizations to improve the life outcomes of Alaska's children and families by transferring negotiated child welfare services and supports along with their respective revenue streams from OCS to the tribal co-signers. Next slide, please. So basically, in sum, the main goal of the Tribal Child Welfare Compact is to provide higher quality services and supports at a lower cost. The Child Welfare Compact was created in 2017, and unlike federal compacting, there isn't a statute that really guides the process. So the two parties, the tribe and the state, really have to do a lot of legwork on the front end, discussing and negotiating what this would actually look like. And over the past few years, they have worked on the dual tasks of drafting compact documents, including those that define the scopes and work and services to be provided, and implementation of the scopes that have already been completed. So I think while the compact seems to be going at a snail's pace, it's really this foundational work that is very necessary because there is no statute writing that's going to determine just how successful we are in implementation and just how far the tribal child welfare compact can go. We recognize, especially in the pandemic, that I think caused an uptick in children going into foster care services, that compacts really have to be nimble and allow for the real life to happen. Pandemics and other issues that come into play in the community, such as housing shortages, healthcare access, and that's what the compact's currently dealing with, is how do we really implement wraparound services for our children and families, and include all the necessary agencies to really make a difference in children and families' lives. I think it's important when deciding about tribal, what would be a big tribal compact in the future, is to really ask ourselves who should really be deciding how to implement a government service. And for on the federal side, it's pretty easy to say, that should probably be in the headquarters of Indian Health Service. Probably shouldn't be calling the shots on how to implement health care in rural Alaska. On the state side, it's kind of the same. Should we have data or Anchorage in deciding how best to protect and provide services to families in rural Alaska? Or should we really give some of that authority and responsibility back to the communities to decide for themselves how best to implement those services? And that's really the question to ask if you're thinking about contacting, for instance, tribal education, tribal public safety, transportation. I think that's an important concept, an important question. feeling that authority and funding have to be passed back with the responsibility of the service in order for the compact to be successful. So that was the end of my presentation.
Sorry, I can answer this question.
Thank you very much, Liz. We were always grateful for you listening. And I guess I kind of wanted to ask a question both of you and maybe as a bill sponsor. And it's with respect to local arrangements for teachers to fight some of these conflicts. I assume that these are the school districts and the teachers, maybe members of the NEA. And my question is, have we thought about preserving those employees' rights to collectively bargain and to be collectively bargaining with the tribe? And or something about the right agency case on the healthcare side, it seems to me that we should be not more deliberate about preserving these employees' collective bargaining rights as they go under a really new model of employment. I don't know if that's something that you and the bill sponsor have talked about, but I would like to see those rights protected, just in recognition of the fact that collective bargaining isn't a universal human right, recognized as a human declaration of human rights. So, anyway, if you want to comment on that,
So, this is our public comment here. It seemed to have been requested to talk broadly about the concept of contacting and it's specifically to this bill. So, we'll intend to interview with those lots of really present the bill in a minute. But if, let's say, if you wouldn't mind making things wrestling how collective bargaining may or may not interrelate with existing federal compact in the state and what have you seen, and just talking about the legal concepts related to collective bargaining and contracting.
Thank you. I guess I'm an attorney, so I think you work down any deal. So I'm very hopeful that within the foundations of compacting, it is possible to preserve these kind of bargaining rights. I haven't specifically been following the right AHC issue, but I know that, for instance, in the Northeast region, there are nurses have sought to organize and unionize and travel organizations that in the interior at least were ready to negotiate if necessary. And I think it's possible, anything's possible.
Okay. Can I just close the loop here? I think that this is maybe not something that we found the most exciting way you went down the road of contacting in terms of healthcare services, and obviously contacting in terms of healthcare services is incredibly beneficial in this time around. I can do that at the front end, it'll just get a little bit here. So I'm happy to follow up with Ms. Fang. Thank you.
Thank you, and just a closing question. You touched on it briefly, but there was hoping you could talk about the importance of negotiated scopes of work within a compact being paired with meaningful funding agreements and how those funding agreements are necessary for the successful delivery of the compact season.
Thank you. Well, in terms of the Union Health Service Compact, the shortfall in the funding really is behavioral health. And both of the behavioral health funding we receive from the federal government is actually in grants. It doesn't come through our compact. And that is extremely problematic. And it's really, you can see over there on the ground, there's a shortcoming in behavioral health services for Alaskans because of the lack of funding there and really the lack of the federal government has decided to keep it in the form of a grant rather than put it through our compact where we're allowed to redesign and in that we're
they identified that dentists in every village are just not going to work in the laptop, so they created the dental health aid therapists. We have the authority to do that and license our dental health aid therapists, and we're able to address, you know, basic cavities and basic needs in rural Alaska, basic dental needs. And for the first time, we're seeing a generation of children that have no cavities or are able to obtain that level of rural health necessary for really overall health. So that is an example of what has worked for the dental program.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Ms. Singh, for joining us and giving us a background and refresher on how vaccinating and contracting in the fall looks like throughout the state, and we appreciate your time today. Next, we will turn to Chief SA34, Senator Stevens, and the staffer, Tim Hennigan, related to state and federal contract rules. Senator Stevens, it's great to see you. Thank you for taking us for opening this morning. And Mr. Wilkin, go ahead and introduce yourself to the record and begin with this morning.
I realize that Just
mission to improve education for every student every day. And our purpose is to provide information and resources and leadership to support an excellent education for every student every day. Our mission, and I think this is a really important one, this is outlined in statute. All students will succeed in their education and work and shape worthwhile and satisfying lives for themselves, designed by the best values of society, and be effective in improving the character and quality of the world around them. And I think that contracting is one of the ways to help make sure they're able to meet our mission, carry our purpose, and enact our mission as a state. And this part of my sample conference is for the department. This came out of what Senator Stevens had mentioned, the Alaska Education Challenge. So if we go to the next slide, these are the strategic priorities for Alaska's Education Challenge. And contracting touches on all five of these. We often talk about anchoring in item number three, or the strategic priority three, that calls the achievement gap by ensuring equitable education, rigor, and resources. We're really going to try to contract and address all five. And the Alaska Education Challenge started in 2016. Is carried out for 2017. It, I forgot the next slide on page 4. This was the strategic priority that came out of the Alaska Education Challenge. So that convening is parents, educators, legislators, community members, students, tribal leaders, government organizations. It really was thousands of people providing input. There was a specific working group on community and tribal ownership of education, and they came up with one strategic priority because they felt so strongly that this was the successful option to help close the achievement gap and to help inspire tribal and community ownership of education excellence. And this was the priority that that committee put forward. It was self-governance contracting to create the option for self-governance contracting for the delivery of education between the state of Alaska and tribes for tribally empowered Alaska organizations. So this was adopted by the State Board of Education as one of the priorities. And if we go to the next slide, slide 5, the department has continued to learn about the legal ins and outs of compacting. The only state that is currently compacting for K-12 education is Washington State. I've been there a couple of times to the Kids Help Academy, which is the one of the tribes that is compacting. It resembles most closely the situation we have here in Alaska for our school situation. The state board has formed a committee to train state board members who are looking into tribal compacting. And this is the committee's mission statement, which is to support tribal compacting by identifying and developing regulations that support the efforts of tribes to help Alaska. And it anchors to that closing achievement gap by ensuring that equitable education regard and resources for our Alaska Education Challenge. So part of what this committee has done is have invited guest speakers on topics like Alaska Native Language, and if it is time presented on compacting, we're looking actively at what regulations are needed for current system, but also what regulations, what those regulations would do to support compacting when compacting comes to fruition. Noting that things like teacher pathways is a really important need for our state right now today, and the compacting in the conversation that we're looking at in FD 34 is that there's a small number of schools. There's still hundreds more schools that have this need for equitable education and regular resources. So we're looking at what regulations support contracting as it comes down the line, but also what are the supports that benefit all students as well as contracting schools. That's a snapshot of what the State Board Tribal Contracting Committee has done. If we go to slide 6, we have any time please interrupt me and ask for questions. So slide 6 is contacting education. This is to recap. We talked about an excellent job that Yale does in talking about contacting. We're going to continue to speak on this topic. that's grounded in contacting a self-determination tribe to determine what works best for the tribe and their people. If I go to slide 7, the partnership of the Alaska Federation of Natives, so we have the department has issued a grant to the AFN, and their role that we're looking at and their deliverables, if you will, is to identify relevant federal and state laws and regulations. And this has been a really valuable partnership. I appreciate Rick being on the line and the work that Jim made and her team has done, the Commission of Lost Cases. Very highly of that work, I can also speak very highly of that partnership and how beneficial it's been. That the inherent nature of tribes having federal trust responsibility is something that makes a lot of federal Indian case law with it. And that's something the state and the Department of Education has less experience with, and AFN has more experience with, to be able to bring up this federal case to this scope of help. So that's been very valuable as they have moved through this process. AFN's also compiling relevant materials, there's different white papers they put out.
This is Rex Zaleski. You indicated that there's a grant that DEA has provided to AFN to provide support regarding this work. Can you give us the amount of that funding?
It was a $1 million grant, and it came from one of the COVID pots of money. It's the second or third wave. I'm sorry, I don't have that acronym right in front of me. That's been where that money came from. Simply affects all people who want to have this education tools available, so it's open to their
It was also a big part of the COVID money, and I will have to follow up with the exact dollar amount. I don't have that note right in front of me, but I don't want to make a thought to the dollar amounts.
So we look forward to having some follow-up from your professor committee on that. Can you talk about what capacity exists at understanding that DEED granted funding to BFM and CITC, my expectation would be that the department is looking to deepen the bench of expertise in this area and maybe doesn't necessarily have a built out system of support within the department directly to be able to advise the work needed to negotiate the terms as spelled out in Investment 34. Can you speak to that?
Yes, to the chair, the Lawyer Department of Education. So, the depth, and to answer the question about different parts, start a committee on it was to help build the capacity for leadership of the Department, to the State Department of Education, and that the need to bring our partners like AFN to help build that capacity of that historical legal framework is one of the things that was identified early on for the department to need to come up to speed on the impacts of contracting. And so there's been other partner organizations that have volunteered. The First Reference Institute has hosted the department with tribal leaders. Again, they volunteered their time to do that, to help very early on, shortly after the Earth Education Challenge, to help build the capacity of the department's understanding of what with considerations for contracting looks like. The other piece to help build up the department's understanding has been talking with Washington State and other states. American Magwell, of the Department of Tribal Liaison, I have monthly calls with all the Indian Education Director Michael Burns, Wright State, and they have talked about the different legal issues that come up with contracting or with how they're addressing these similar needs in different states around the country to help with answering those kinds of capacity building pieces and looking at what they have done. And so that's the level of expertise currently. My position, this is the main thing that I focus on as a project coordinator, is contracting. And so I hope that answers your question. I'm happy to stay further if that'd be helpful.
Another question, looking at the text of the bill itself, broadly speaking, it identifies that the State Board of Education would negotiate the terms of the demonstration compact. What would that entail? Would that be with respect to scopes of work, the legal documents that actually needed to do this work, addressing the potential collective bargaining issues that Representative Fields spoke about a bit earlier, potential funding agreements, and how those would work within those respective school sites? Can you talk just broadly and generally about what the terms that the department envisions being included in those negotiations would deliver to the legislature?
Yes, to the Chair, the Department of Education. So, the negotiation components for what we would anticipate seeing would be things like your student operational, there's a certain level of operational questions, if you will, or operational topics that would be included in what would be outlined. And then, exactly what you said, the need to talk through those ins and outs of what does the bargaining unit look like, what does potential building use look like, what do transportation questions look like, those kinds of things that can branch from just certainly administrative pieces of like attendance records and kind of data-driven points to we start to have services that are rendered to help support education. And then you actually have the education service of the teaching taking place. So that's what I would anticipate seeing in the negotiation. And the process we're getting there is the department communicating communicating out a more articulated version of what I told you in the committee. So there's something for tribes to be able to have a framework to build out from. And these are not wildly abstract concepts. These are based around what does it look like in the student to operate a school, what is the educational role, and those kinds of questions being you go through and answer those. But some of those answers are going to vary depending on which location in the state. And it depends on what number of students and all those variables that are just unknown of those kinds of questions the department can provide you together, and that's part of what will help inform what would be put out to the parents and what parents can expect to respond to. The other piece is not to stifle, but what the child's view of what it needs to be is to allow for that child's voice to be part of that. So it's not a one-time communication with them. It's a series. It's an ongoing conversation back and forth to be able to really round out what that is. That's, again, why I can't give it a brand. It looks like this. Because by nature, this is an iterative process. This is a partnership of dynamic. And that's part of the powerful benefit of contracting, is that it's not so static and rigid. It addresses this systemic issue of needing to have that flexibility and that partnership that's created, and addresses that other level. And so that's why negotiation doesn't give you a yes or no answer. It gives you an overview. And there are things that we still don't know, even after all the conversations that we have, and we'll come up with in negotiations, and being able to have that time for trials to inform and be part of that process, is again another benefit of negotiation. Because even though the department would get a fair bit of outreach and have public forums and academic conferences, they can come and ask some questions in a university setting, in a community setting, there's still a need for that travel list to be at every part of the process. So I'll pause there. And yeah, I might have missed part of your question. No, so if I do, please just follow
up. I think you've helped me understand a bit more with respect to the context of resources available within the department for this world on that anticipated goals at the outset of what that looks like. And you help me understand, since it sounds like the department has had to grant over $1 million in funding to external travel subject matter experts in the pursuit of this work. And as you mentioned, you're one individual within the department that has familiarity with these answers, but may not necessarily be the subject matter expert. When the department envisions a zero fiscal note in the upon passage of this bill, to very complicated legal preparation for a demonstration project, from what I understand as it relates to tribal compacting. The tribes obviously are very excited about the potential success in partnership with EAD in this area. And as you've indicated, tribes are already underway in the state themselves by volunteering their own powers, their own salaries, in essentially putting forward expertise on a topic that might be interested in hearing the department's perspective about why a zero fiscal note would be able to ensure that we're studying SB 34 for success, but upon potential implementation.
Can I share the last Dr. Ginger, the Department of Education, so I think is the question. And there's a brief answer, and then I will explain a little bit further. So the brief answer is the department currently, as it's requested, has the capacity to absorb the fiscal impact if this bill passes. So it's a way of the department continuing to show a strong fiscal commitment to this work. The bill itself allows a way to point into a fiscal support in a very clear direction. And the department saying, in the fiscal note, saying that the deed has the capacity to absorb the fiscal impact and has a zero fiscal note, report does have, I've had conversations with clients in the last few weeks, especially not just the school client, because it's going to start contacting the school year. SB34 is really about coming up with a clear proposal to the legislature to come back with some answers to these very technical questions and investing time and resources into answering the questions different than funding the school. So I've had to have the opportunity to express and explain that process. If this was starting a school, that would be a different kind of expenditure than where we're at right now with SB34. And I'll pause there. That's just that's the way that this will be interacted in that way.
So my question, but maybe a follow-up comment, that as I look to the elected Georgia Chapels, I contact with some expertise as Commissioner of the House Health and Social Services Committee, and hopefully we can, within this committee, understanding state and tribal compact in Alaska. And because that compact has been essentially self-funded since inception, tribes have been a bit in a stagnant position with respect to being in a place of constant implementation and helping to build out capacity. And while that speaks to the direct funding agreement with, as it relates to the compact, without additional support to the Office of Children Services for the implementation of that work, there's been a bit of a tricky cycle since Senator did that compact, where they haven't been able to move the needle in the way that it's been envisioned. And I guess I would air some concern to the department in terms of the complexity of compacting in an area of education where the state is constitutionally bound to provide equitable access for education to all of the Alaskan students. That it's essential that if we want to set up tribes in the state for success in pursuing this endeavor, that the department really needs to consider a strong look at requiring tribes to consistently underwrite the state's efforts in addressing disparities of state-funded programs. These programs are funded by the state, they're constitutionally required by the state, but they're not putting forward a meaningful potential fiscal investment in the pursuit of this work to get it right. Essentially, shift costs to tribes because they would be engaging with their best interest. And while I respect that the state has looked at the opportunity to leverage federal tribal resources, I think it becomes very problematic when the state consistently looks at putting the burden that is directly borne by the state onto tribes, and they don't want to see happen. Such a good piece of legislation to go unfunded, because I think that the product that comes from passage of the bill in SB34 has the potential to be transformative, and I don't think it's the constitutional obligation to tribes to provide that education, but instead the state. And so I would really encourage the department to take a better look at its potential fiscal note and that it's prepared to invest in ensuring that this is going right for the benefit of all Alaska students. Any questions? Other questions from any members of Representative Torres?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just was curious, Mr. Isaac, you said that Washington was the other state that you were aware of that was doing tribal contacting for education, and if you have any lessons learned or insights from, what you've seen them doing and how they've done it.
Yes, thank you, Chair, Representative Torres, Isaac Department of Education. I appreciate the question. There are some other important promotions to take, and one of them has to do with the question previously that was brought up about teachers. And that was one of the pieces that they came back after their initial bill passed and did some little conflict of cleanup, if you will, to be able to address the concerns that were raised during the process. And so I think that's one of the things that we can definitely learn from is what think you have to address that piece. The other thing I think is part of the process is Washington started off a pilot. And they had an initial, not all the tribes, there's seven, not all of them qualified in the right way. They started with the tribes that were really exposed to readiness and started with there. They built in lookbacks, so that the first year there was a very in-depth lookback, the second year, very in-depth lookback, and as it got to the fifth year, there was an in-depth lookback, and then the seventh year, there was a kind of end-of-pilot review, and then there, it was found to be successful, and they stayed and thrived together to bring every tribe into that combating effort. So that piloting with that slow and steady to build capacity and work through the legal matters, see what's working, what's not working, make sure that there is a process like ending negotiations to be able to dynamically respond to what are system issues that need to be addressed, what are funding issues that need to be addressed. That's part of what created success in Washington. And that's where what I think is my strength in the conversation around SB 34 is that it intrusion. It allows to show a response to very targeted questions. Like, which parts are successful? How do we define success? What does it look like from an operational side? Those are some of the things that Washington State did that we can learn from. And also, it's built into the we have in front of us today. One of the other things that I've done for looking at Washington State is comparing Title 14 with Washington State statutes that are explicitly included in their compact to see, like, does Washington have a vastly different legal framework for education than we do? That's an important consideration to when you're comparing things. And they're graphite in Washington are comparing similar apples to similar apples. They have some slightly now a little bit more statutory obligations than we do for certain content areas, but the actual mechanisms of how they fund education, how they do reporting, is very similar to the last year. They have a pathway structure. One of the big differences from Washington that we do need to take into consideration is that Washington State is dealing with tribes and reservations, where Alaska has not the case in Alaska for the reservation component as a whole. There's tribes have a different process that we have learned predominantly as well. So that was some of the lessons learned from Washington State and the considerations for how we need to kind of be aware of what's going on in Washington. Alaska has the tribes in Alaska do have federal custody of the federal government, but there are different legal pieces with Alaska Native tribes than there are for 48 tribes around education. So we're looking at that for lessons learned from Washington as well.
Thank you, Chair. That's really encouraging that we're, sounds like we're kind of following what has been a successful example for the state of Washington, but doing this kind of pilot and taking those lessons learned. And I also agree with your comments about making sure that there truly are the resources necessary. That would definitely be something that we've been working with around this committee, but it makes a difference when there's a person whose job it is to get up every day and do that. And there's of course, a lot of work to be done, so I hope we can consider whether there is a need for additional resources to support that.
Any other questions or comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wanted to thank the nurse team and the department for working with us. Very exciting, and I think it probably won't change the role we've done after.
I would like to thank everybody opportunity before we had to. But Mr. Lampe, I hope you will indicate to some of our students how grateful we are that he brought this all forward this session and all the good work that's been done on it. Now, before we look to conclude today's committee hearing, anything further for the Commissioner's Office on consideration of SB 34?
To our constructive questions, I think we've covered this about pretty well. As an introductory level, I don't want to take up any of your time.
extremely